It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert. Thank you for your support during our year-end mini-pledge drive. 1,100 of you pledged $156,000, and we're so grateful for your financial support.
If you haven't pledged yet, you can still help with a year-end gift. Go to WPR.org. That's WPR.org, and it'll take you through making that donation. Still coming up today on Central Time, a look at news on chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin deer.
First, a related topic. A new report outlines the threat that climate change could pose for deer, moose, elk, caribou, and other large mammals.
The report is from the National Wildlife Federation. It's called Nowhere to Run: Big Game Wildlife in a Warming World. Ryan Stockwell joins us now. He's Senior Agriculture Program Manager for the National Wildlife Federation. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Rob.
So first, give us a rundown of the range of species that you're looking at in this report.
So this report looked at a number of big game species across the North American continent. So that would include whitetail deer that we're all familiar with, as well as black-tailed deer, moose, caribou, as well as bear and antelope.
And a lot of these stories, there's backstory here, there were success stories in the past. Can you talk about the restoration effort that brought them back to where they are today?
Certainly. So if we go back in time and take a look at settlement across the continent, we'll see that as that settlement occurred, wildlife species, and particularly big game species, their populations declined precipitously for a number of reasons, predominantly because there was such a tremendous interest in hunting and killing off a lot of these species. However, at the turn of the 20th century and into about the 1930s, we started developing a scientific awareness of the importance of a lot of these species. And so efforts began to develop to protect these species, to bring their populations back up to more manageable and sustainable levels so that it did not have those low populations did not have detrimental effects on the entire ecosystems in which they operate. And a number of those species were brought back from the brink of extinction all the way back to more manageable and sustainable levels.
And Wisconsin had a role there. Aldo Leopold was one of the people who helped that restoration, right?
That's correct. He was helped in a lot of the science and management for ecosystems and big game management, and he played a significant role in guiding the direction of how to implement a lot of these plans to ensure that we have and continue to have big game.
How important for our economies are these species when we factor in not just the hunting, but also tourism related to them, photography?
Certainly. So big game species across the continent, in 2011, some of our most recent data, we had about 16 million adult-aged hunters going after big game, and that contributed over $16 billion to the economy. And then when you add in the other components of enjoying big game, of just observing and photography, that number in terms of economic impact more than doubles.
So this is of interest to hunters and non-hunters?
Exactly. This is a significant hobby that, in fact, we have more people who participate in the observation and photography of big game than hunting.
Well, let's look at the problem you're seeing now. We'll delve into details and species by species, but overall, how is climate change affecting these large mammals in the United States?
So the significant direction, if we can try to generalize here for a second, the significant direction that climate change and significant impact that climate change has on these big species is by shifting weather patterns and shifting then habitats, which respond to changes in climate over time. And then we can get into more specifics, but the additional factor is that as these climates change, that also changes then pests as well as predators for these species, which when they're not acclimated to these changing conditions, they do not fare very well.
And let's pursue one of those. Now, white-tailed deer is not an animal a lot of people would think of as threatened in any way. In some places, they're seen as a nuisance animal. But one of the disease issues that you're looking at, you're worried in the long run. Talk about disease that affects deer here in Wisconsin and in our neighboring states.
Certainly. So the disease that has been cropping up as climate change has taken a hold is hemorrhagic disease. And that is essentially a disease passed on among deer by midges, or real small biting flies. And this disease then causes deer to bleed out internally or externally. They become more susceptible to other diseases and die off. And a good example of what we will likely see with further climate change actually happened back in 2012. During that year, which most of you will recall was a significant drought year, we saw in that situation deer will tend to congregate at watering holes that are remaining, and so their opportunities to spread out and get water at different locations declines, and so they need to congregate, and then they become more susceptible to the midges, which also are at these watering holes. In 2012, a number of Midwestern states experienced a tremendous rise in the incidence of hemorrhagic disease, going from Nebraska, which saw an estimated 10 to 15,000 loss in deer population due to the disease. Missouri, same numbers. Even Michigan, much closer to Wisconsin, saw similar impacts of this disease of losing a significant portion of the deer population. In each of these circumstances, that resulted in the state game management deciding to limit hunting opportunities by reducing the tag numbers being allotted. And so that certainly has implications for, as we talked about earlier, the economy, but also for the opportunity for sportsmen and women to enjoy the opportunity to hunt these species.
So is that an example of a fairly common story, a combination of something carrying a disease, maybe expanding its range, an annual condition, something like a drought, making the animals, the big game animals, behave in a way they don't usually do, maybe congregating like the deer did, and that's kind of perfect storm, making these diseases more likely?
Exactly. Some species are more adept at managing climate change and dealing with changing conditions than others are. And typically our big game are very slow to adapt to these changes. However, the insects and the parasites are fairly quick at adapting to these changing conditions. And so they get a leg up during these times of change. And that's the case with the midges with the hemorrhagic disease, and that's also the case with deer ticks and Lyme's disease, which impacts not just big game species, but also human populations as well.
We also have elk being restored over time here in Wisconsin. How are they faring in your report?
Elk, in a similar situation, or elk are a little bit different in that our report looks at elk more in the western populations where they're more commonly known to reside. In those situations, what we've seen is that in addition to climate change, which has, again, with droughts and these long-term weather patterns impacted by climate change, which reduce the habitat value for the elk, we're also seeing a lot of oil and gas development, which fragments their habitats. And that creates tremendous difficulty for migration and for maintaining those populations.
We're talking to Ryan Stockwell with the National Wildlife Federation about a new report on big game species in the United States and threats they face because of climate change.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a question about how this affects deer, elk, caribou, black bear, other large mammals? If you're a hunter, are you worried about what you're hearing? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org.
Now we'll continue our conversation about moose, elk, deer, caribou, black bears, other big mammals in the United States, and how climate change might affect them. Ryan Stockwell is with us to talk about a new report from the National National Wildlife Federation. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you someone who goes on tours to see these kind of animals? Deer, obviously, we see here in Wisconsin, but have you gone out to see caribou, elk herds? Or are you a hunter of those kinds of animals? Are you concerned about this? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Well, Ryan, some animals that might be more exotic for us here in Wisconsin I want to get into. Pronghorn sheep. What does the report tell us about them?
So the report for pronghorn is very similar to elk and mule deer in the western portions of the continent, in that in combination with the drought, which has an impact on their sage habitat area, reducing the vegetation, we're also, again, seeing a lot of habitat fragmentation due to oil and gas development. And that fragmentation then minimizes their migratory patterns, which are necessary for their survival, and at the same time also tends to congregate their populations more densely. In that situation, what we see is an increasing likeliness that diseases will spread more quickly through the pronghorn population.
So we've sampled a few of the animals you talk about in the report, and maybe we'll get to some more, but I don't want to let the time get away without asking you, what are your recommendations? Are there specific things to help these species, or is this a matter of big picture stuff on climate change?
It's really a combination of the two. So our first recommendation, obviously, is to address climate change, to find solutions and begin to address the root problem of what we see going on with big game. But secondly, there are some specifics that we can implement, and first and foremost is to minimize habitat fragmentation. So while climate change continues to go on, we need to learn to adapt to that and also to preserve as much opportunity for wildlife to maintain their populations as possible. And so first and foremost would be minimizing the amount of fragmentation going on. And secondly would be to bring in more science to find strategies to for our management, to change our management strategies to adapt, help big game adapt to this changing climate scenario.
Right. Edward from Polk County, Wisconsin, says he does deer processing in northwestern Wisconsin. A lot of the avid hunters, he tells us, are avid Republicans, don't believe in global warming. He asks, how do you get the message out to these people about what's happening to the deer and these other species?
Well, I'm also a hunter, and I'm in Taylor County, so he's not too far from me. And I have similar concerns about deer populations. It's always anytime talking about climate change can be a touchy subject. But one thing that is for certain is that our deer populations that we all enjoy to go out and hunt and observe are facing some real and significant difficulties. And we need to find ways and need to be smart managers about ensuring their populations so that we can enjoy them as outdoor sportsmen and women, but that so also future generations can enjoy them.
And in the initial response to your report, are you hearing from, say, hunters, organizations, sportsmen groups wanting to get on board with this?
Absolutely. We have received some good initial interest from a number of organizations that this report fits into the thinking that good, sound management of big game is necessary to ensure our long-term opportunities, that we have worked so hard to bring these big game back into conservation numbers so that we can enjoy them. It would be a tremendous shame to just let that fall away because we're not willing to recognize and address the climate change challenges facing these big game.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. That's the number to call if you want to join in, 800-642-1234. We have Roger with us in Montello. Roger, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
Thank you for taking my call. You mentioned that Michigan and Nebraska had significant midge hemorrhagic disease. Well, I'm here to tell you that Aaron Joseph found 25 deer down by Kiganza that were dead. And Paul checked with my poinette, found 25 to 30 deer that were dead. My son took a walk in 2012, squirrel hunting, and found 3 deer, and he was out for about an hour and a half. We had a significant kill here in the southern part of the state of Wisconsin with a hemorrhagic disease, and they were mainly bucks. My comment, I'll let you just continue. You seem to be covering a lot of bases. I'll listen. Bye.
But thanks a lot for the call, Roger. So, Ryan, I think you mentioned that the hemorrhagic disease among deer had been spotted in Wisconsin. Is it as wide-ranging as Roger is mentioning?
It is exactly as Roger mentioned it, that hemorrhagic disease is spreading north into Wisconsin. We had, as he mentioned, this year we have some incidences of it. Last year during the drought, and again, as we mentioned, the incidence of that increases with drought. We had higher numbers still last year, and we just have to go back a few years to 2002. That was the first outbreak of hemorrhagic disease in Wisconsin. So this is a very new and very serious problem that will only continue to grow without addressing some of the root issues.
Another species, not here in Wisconsin, but very close to our borders, and we've talked about this a little on the show, a moose. I know trouble in Minnesota's moose populations in the western and northeastern parts of the state. Can you talk about them a little?
Certainly. What we have found is that moose, being such a large animal, are quite sensitive to small changes in temperature. And also, moose being very acclimated and built for cold climates, and with Minnesota being their very southernmost region and territory, they're going to feel the brunt of climate change the earliest and the first. And so what we've seen with the moose populations in both the northwest portion as well as the northeast is significant declines very recently over the last 10 or 12 years. And this is to the point that that they ended hunting of moose in the northwest portion of Minnesota back in 1997. And just this year, in 2013, they canceled the moose season because of rapid declines in moose populations.
So one question, why don't animals, wouldn't animals just start ranging further north if there's a general increase in temperatures, or is it not that simple?
Unfortunately, it's not that simple. Animals have a difficult time sensing these very small changes. And then secondly, to recognize a solution to such wide-ranging and large problems. One can only imagine in their mind that if they're recognizing that it's getting warm out, their assumption is it's warm out everywhere rather than trying to trend north. So it takes a very long-term process for wildlife to respond to this, and oftentimes it's not accomplished by a single generation, but just purely by selection of populations to the north and colder areas perhaps having a little more chance of survival and southern populations dying out.
Well, and I suppose part of the problem is that it isn't so much a steady increase in temperature as a steady increase in unpredictability. Maybe an extreme drought this year, flooding the next, early frost one year and late frost another.
Exactly. And in 2012, you know, we just about saw all of that from early spring to a late frost, then to a drought, to a long fall. And it just, these problems compound one another. And wildlife really have nowhere to, no easy sense of recognizing what the problem is or how to deal with it.
There's been talk lately, various scientists saying we're past a tipping point with climate change. The best we can do is limit the impact, but we're pretty much riding the roller coaster in that direction, and there's no going back. How do you feel? Are you optimistic about these species that you're talking about, elk, moose, caribou, and deer, in the face of climate change?
I am optimistic. I think if we get down to business and recognize the need to do what we can to protect their existing habitat, especially some of the core areas of habitat that are vital and valuable to these species, minimize the fragmentation of habitat that we see going on throughout the continent, and then implement sound science to address these climate issues and address diseases as they arrive, we are going to have a good success at maintaining these valuable big game populations.
We'll leave it there. Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Ryan Stockwell. He's with the National Wildlife Federation talking about a new report on large mammals, big game species in the United States.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for your support during today's year-end mini pledge drive. 1,100 of you pledged for a total of over $156,000. We are so grateful for your support.
If you haven't yet pledged, you can do so at WPR.org and make your year-end gift.
Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an author of many hit zombie books, including World War Z. He's speaking in Madison tonight and will join us to talk about the appeal of the apocalypse.
But first, we're talking about a story out of Marathon County. A deer killed on a hunting reserve there tested positive for chronic wasting disease, or CWD.
It's the first case of CWD found on a Wisconsin game farm in 5 years.
Covering the story for WPR News is Glenn Moberg, a reporter based in Wausau. He's with us now to fill us in. Glenn, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, hi, Cynthia. Hi, Rob. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, can you explain why it's significant that we found CWD on a farm preserve?
Well, this is the first time they found an infected deer on a game farm in Wisconsin since October of 2008. So it's a pretty rare situation, and it's significant because, of course, they're worried that this disease will spread to other animals, and if you have a herd of animals confined behind chain link fences, even under a situation where there are lots of acreage involved. In this case, there were 351 acres on this hunting preserve. The worry is that it will spread easily to large numbers of animals. And in fact, that did happen back in 2006 in another central Wisconsin incident. There were 82 deer that got infected by chronic wasting disease on a game farm in Portage County, and all of those animals were eventually destroyed.
Mm. Do we know that that deer came or belonged to that herd, or might it have been a wild deer that had gone astray and entered that area?
No, they don't think that's possible because the hunting preserve had and has a double chain link fence around it as required by law. So they don't think the animals have gone in and out of that preserve. But it was shot by a hunter on the preserve on November 4th. And then according to the Department of Agriculture rules, there's routine testing that takes place. So on November 7th at the National Veterinary Services Lab in Ames, Iowa, it did turn up positive. So what they've done right now is they have quarantined that farm. It's a 351-acre hunting preserve, and it's near Eland, which is on the Marathon County, Shawano County border. And they've also quarantined three other nearby game farms that are affiliated with the same owners. They're not identifying the owners at this point, but from my understanding, the owners will be allowed to continue to have hunts on the preserve. Because the infected deer, if they're killed, well, they're not going to move anywhere, and they'll stay on site and have no contact with other animals outside of the game farm. But that quarantine will keep the deer on those preserves from moving from area to area while the state conducts its investigation.
Mm. And looking at that timeline, so the tissue was submitted for testing on November 7th. It's December 3rd, 4th? I've lost track of the day already. Nearly a month. And what kind of damage might be done to the deer that are still living there in that time frame?
Well, they're going to have to do some tests. They're going to have to find out if the disease has spread. And the thing that we need to stress here is that the disease, chronic wasting disease, cannot be spread to human beings. As far as all of the scientific evidence we have, the Department of Health still recommends that venison from infected deer not be consumed, but that's precautionary. There's been no incident reported in which human beings have come down with chronic wasting disease. However, it is similar to mad cow disease. These are both diseases known as spongiform encephalopathies, which attack brain tissue and spinal cord tissue. And mad cow disease has killed a couple of hundred people, mostly in Great Britain, when it gets spread to human beings, where it's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. But that's mad cow disease. It is not chronic wasting disease, although they're related. And we need to make sure that people who are listening understand that there's a difference between the two, and chronic wasting disease cannot be spread to human beings.
What does it do to deer?
Well, it causes them to become very listless and to become emaciated, and eventually it kills them. It's nearly always fatal. And again, this is a disease that causes behavior problems, and it attacks the brain and spinal tissue, literally rotting it from the inside.
Have you heard at all any hypotheses or any theories as to how the CWD got onto that game farm, if not through some sort of external contamination?
They're still trying to figure that out. And what I was told by Rachel Klein, who is the public information official with the division that's involved with this, with the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, she says that they're called prions, which are an unnatural form of protein that spreads this disease. And if an animal gets it and dies, those prions go into the ground and they stay there forever. So what they're going to have to do right now is figure out how the disease got there, and then they're going to have to figure out to the extent to which it is spread to other animals in the herd, and whether or not drastic measures are going to have to be taken. In terms of how chronic wasting disease got to Wisconsin, it wasn't even something that we had to deal with here until 2002, relatively recently. And the theory is that it originated out west, and deer found a way to migrate here.
Hmm. Well, I'm wondering about the future of this farm in particular. If CWD is on the property, what would that mean for their ability to have future deer herds there?
That's a question that I don't know the answer of, and I don't know if the state officials know the answer to that one either. If worse comes to worse, they would have to kill all the deer on the property, from what I was told today. And then I guess if they want to continue using it as a hunting preserve, they'd have to start a new herd from scratch. And I don't know enough. I'm not a scientist to tell you the extent to which even that's something that's conceivable.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard at all in terms of the deer hunt that's been going on so far this season, whether this has been a huge issue for hunters right now, or is it too soon to tell?
I think, first of all, it's too soon to tell. And the indication that I have seen is that it hasn't been spread throughout the state of Wisconsin in the wild deer herd. We had concerns in the special zone that was set up in the southwestern portion of the state. But it made news earlier this year. In fact, it was very early in the year in January, where a couple of infected deer, wild deer, turned up, one in Portage County and one in Juneau County, both in central Wisconsin. And that kind of raised some eyebrows because they were outside of this zone. But I do not believe, and the authorities do not believe, that chronic wasting disease is something that's rampant throughout the entire deer herd and something most hunters have to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. What is your next step here in reporting this story?
Well, the next step is we see how the state investigation goes, and we see what they decide to do with the animals that are on that herd, the extent to which animals throughout that hunting preserve have been infected. Whether or not they're all going to have to be destroyed, whether or not maybe this is just one isolated incident. And it's too soon to tell. Again, this is a story that just broke yesterday. So we're still waiting to see what happens.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, Cynthia, thanks so much.
Glenn Moberg is WPR's news reporter based in Wausau.
From the Book of Revelations to the Hunger Games, we humans have spent a lot of time thinking about the apocalypse and the dystopia that might come after. Our next guest has made his mark on the subject. He's Max Brooks, author of The Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z, which spun off a movie of the same name. His current comic book series is Extinction Parade. Max Brooks is speaking in Madison tonight, and he joins us now in the studio. Max, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So apocalypses are really bad, if I can understate it a little. Why do we like to read about them and watch TV shows and movies about them?
Well, I think we're living in very uncertain times. I think the last time you had this deluge of apocalyptic media was the 1970s. You had Soylent Green and Ultimate Warrior and a little movie called Dawn of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we instinctively want to explore the apocalypse when we see what we think is the system breaking down. And I think the 1970s was exactly like the time we're living in now. People had a sense that things weren't working. And I think it's human nature to look ahead and think, well, what's the end game? But it's also human nature to turn away if it's a little too real. So you put a little science fiction on there, you make the catalyst fake, say zombies, and then you can watch the apocalypse.
That's interesting. Is that part of the particular appeal of zombies, which are big in your works and obviously elsewhere?
Yeah, because you know zombies are not they're not a predatory metaphor, say the way a werewolf or a giant shark is, because you can just get away from those. If there's a giant shark in the water, don't go in the water. Zombies are really slate wipers. They really are apocalyptic. The stories are global, and I think they're a great metaphor for major global catastrophes, which we have been battered with, I think, the last decade.
And it seems like zombies can serve as a metaphor for whatever you need in a lot of ways. It could be the communists out there or the consumer mindset here or eco-disaster or disease.
Yes.
It's a little bit of all of it.
What I find very interesting is I think they're a Rorschach test for whatever scares us. You know, I've done a lot of zombie panels and a lot of zombie interviews with a lot of zombie authors, but all these authors tend to be coming from fields of specialization. And they always have to put their specialist stamp on it. If someone studies viruses, they go, oh, no, 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 it's a metaphor for plague. That's it. That's all. And then you've got economists who say, oh, no, 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 this is for the financial meltdown. That's it. That's all. If you're watching Fox News, it says, no, 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 it's liberals and people with college degrees.
So they're my zombies, whatever my turf happens to be. I'm going to take the zombies in and claim them as my own.
That's pretty much what I have seen in the last 10 years and watching the zombie culture flourish is people use it as an outgrowth for whatever really scares them.
Well, one thing you've been working on, I think, and the government has taken on is using fictional zombies to help prepare us for real disasters. How does that work?
Oh, definitely. And that's what I'm talking about tonight. 10 years ago, when I sat down to write Zombie Survival Guide, actually, wait, let me correct myself. It came out 10 years ago. I'm really getting old. I'm starting to do that old person thing where you sort of subtract 10 years to everything you say. I actually started writing it in the late 90s in response to Y2K. And when I was writing it, I realized everything in this book is no different than my earthquake disaster preparedness training. I mean, I live in L.A., and we've been preparing for earthquakes. So everything in my kit is my earthquake kit, and everything in my book is just preparing for a natural disaster.
Is it a sexier way to get us to think about natural disasters? We maybe don't take the real disasters as seriously. They're kind of boring.
I would do the reverse. I would say they're not sexy as far as they are safe. You know, if you go to a party and you say, hey, how would you guys survive a zombie apocalypse? It would be a lively discussion about bottled water and about preserving food and medical care and who would you need with certain specialist skills. And it would be an interesting night, yet an informative night. But you walk into a room and say, hey, I hear that AIDS just went airborne. How would we survive that? Bang, you would clear the room.
It would be the kind of a Debbie Downer approach to party conversation.
Well, you know, people instinctively turn away from things that are too scary, and that's why the CDC is so brilliant. I think it's the first time in my lifetime the federal government has been actually cool, because what they've realized is this is a great way to get young people thinking about what to do in a quarantine. But you don't say an actual quarantine. You say zombies. But guess what? If these young people going on the website of the CDC and preparing a zombie kit, they're ready for a quarantine.
What other tips can we learn from the idea of a zombie attack or a zombie quarantine that could apply for us in the real world for a real disaster preparation?
Well, if you look at any sort of natural disasters or man-made disasters, most people don't actually die of primary effect. What I call is if there's an earthquake, most people are not going to die in the actual earthquake. They're going to die of secondary and tertiary problems, disease, dehydration, starvation, accidents, which in my mind is exactly what would happen if there was a real zombie plague. Mm-hmm. For every person bitten by a zombie, there's a lot of people going to die of tetanus.
Right. So the water sanitation plant isn't open anymore in the zombie attack, and the grocery stores and the health clinics.
Exactly. What I've always said about zombies is they serve two purposes, if done right. They can, if done right, teach us what to do when the lights go out. but also if done right, they can teach us why the lights stay on in the first place. And I think that's becoming more and more important for people. I think we need to really examine where civilization comes from. Where does the electricity come from? Who pipes the water into my house? Who pipes the poop out of my house? Who picks up my garbage so it doesn't pile up and infect me? There's a lot of systems that keep us clean and healthy and civilized, which would break down in a disaster.
So by thinking about the absence in the case of the zombie attack, we learn to appreciate what we've got.
And I think that's very important now. I think, you know, we have a growing political forum in our country that calls for less government, which I'm sorry, to me sounds like less civilization. And as someone who has traveled around the world where I see a lot less civilization than we got, I'm very happy to have the poop piped out of my house, let me tell you.
Well, moving back to your fiction, you've added another layer of monster and maybe of metaphor in Extinction Parade. There's not just zombies now, as I understand it. There are vampires, too. How do they fit into the zombie world?
They, for me, fit perfectly into the zombie world because I've written so much about physical preparedness for a crisis. I've written about how would individuals prepare and how would governments prepare in World War Z. But this is emotional preparedness. This is the emotional, psychological survival kit that we carry in our hearts and our minds. And I've come to learn that that kit is built on struggle. That the more you struggle, the more you fail, the more you learn from your mistakes, the better equipped you are for life, for adversity that's going to come your way. And if you've never had to deal with that, you are not ready for anything, and that is my vampires. They are at the top of the food chain, apex predators. They've never had to struggle. They've never felt fear. They've never had to run for their lives, and therefore, they've never had to compensate. And so suddenly, here comes an existential threat. Their food is being eaten out from under them. What do they do as a species that has never had to struggle?
Resilience, it sounds like, is what I've heard it called by psychologists, having
yes.
that state of resilience, whether we're talking about humans or vampires.
And that, as I get older, becomes more important to me now that I'm a parent. And now that I see that there's a generation of young people coming up behind me where a good cross-section of them have never failed. They've been taught that they're awesome. And there's nothing in their way. Their parents go to job interviews with them. Their parents call up their professors and yell at them because their feelings were hurt. And it scares me because I think that doesn't prepare you for bad things that are going to knock on your door. And let's be honest, bad stuff happens no matter how coddled you are. And that, to me, is my vampires. They are the Kardashians, the Hiltons. They are this new generation that loves just wealth and success and joy and has never had to get their hands dirty.
Do you think that even if we don't face real-world examples of needing resilience, maybe rehearsing them through fiction, through vampires facing an ecological disaster, can teach us a little about it?
Well, I think that's what good science fiction should be. And I'm not saying that's me. I'm saying these are the people that inspired me. You know, I learned so much about life reading Robert Heinlein. And I learned about our government reading Tom Clancy. I think, you know, good science fiction, be it Star Trek or Twilight Zone, anything Richard Matheson throws up, really teaches us how to deal with life, or at least warns us that there's bad things waiting for us.
So your next project is a very different one. No zombies, no vampires. You're going back. It's the 100th anniversary coming up of World War I. Where does Harlem Hellfighters take us?
That is a story I've been trying to get out for about 15 years. And it's a true story. It's based on, my version is based on the true story of a group of African-American soldiers set up to fail by their own government, were then kicked over to the French army, who would take anybody at this point. They were so desperate. And these Americans, in spite of being set up to fail, became the most decorated, one of the most decorated units in the U.S. Army.
So I don't know if there's a line there from zombies and vampires to this, but the resilience theme, the overcoming adversity theme, really does seem to carry through there.
Oh, no. You want to talk about resilience. You want to talk about overcoming obstacles. I mean, these guys came out of that war as genuine heroes.
All right. We just have less than a minute left. Can you leave us with one or two tips on the off chance, fingers crossed, that there is an outbreak of zombieism?
Don't panic. Panic will kill you faster than any zombie. Just take a breath. Look around. You've been given this amazing brain by God or nature, whoever you want to give the credit to. Use your brain.
And that, I bet, could apply to any old disaster, too, even the real ones.
Even the real ones.
Max, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it. That was Max Brooks, author of World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide. His new comic series is Extinction Parade. He's speaking tonight at, I think it's 7:30 at UW-Madison's Union South.